I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
I'm going to give the audience what I think they want.
They want chase scenes and car crashes.
They want the cops to bend the rules to get the job done. They want the boy to get the girl. They want the good guy to win. They want the bad guy to die, hopefully in the biggest explosion the budget will allow. But most importantly, Senator, they want to walk into a theater and for 90 minutes forget the fucking mess that you have left of this nation.
Go get your bubble gum.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Hello and welcome back to the All Out of Bubblegum podcast. Today, me, Marty, am joined by Brandon.
Hello.
And just like last year, Zach is back with us for a Blaxploitation episode. Hello, Zach.
Hello.
Good to have you back.
Yeah, happy to be back. You know, it's kind of funny that I seem to have become the go-to Blaxploitation expert around here.
Yeah.
Because I don't consider myself an expert in this particular subgenre. I mean, I haven't even seen the Black Gestapo yet, so clearly my knowledge of Blaxploitation filmmaking is incomplete. But I guess the main reason I'm here is back in 2017, and I mentioned this last episode, I did a whole month of reviews of Blaxploitation films on my, I have a personal blog, zacksfilmthoughts.blogspot.com, that I have wasted entirely too much time of my life working on over the last decade and a half. And as part of these Blaxploitation reviews, I included a very AOBG-like checklist of reoccurring tropes that you find in many of these films. Very few films have all 12, but all of the films feature some of these tropes.
Like, I think I've seen this before. Is it like, there's always a pimp character kind of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Here, let me just go through and...
Yeah, we'll definitely link to your blog in the description.
Thanks. The amount of people who read what I write versus the amount of time and effort I put into what I do is greatly out of whack, but... You know, you do it for the love of the game.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so the Blaxploitation checklist that just me, as one pasty white dude on the internet, assembled is the 12 tropes are afros or sideburns, brothels or pimps, churches or pastors, funky soundtracks, which almost any film in this genre is going to have, homophobic caricatures, inner city settings, nightclub acts, plot involving drugs or organized crime, racist authority figures, sticking it to the man, sweet love making, and use of street slang.
Okay, so Dolomite, it wins! It's a bingo! It's got all of them, right?
Yeah. Almost, oh. Yeah. The first Dolomite has pretty much all of them. I mean, I guess you can debate whether or not there is a homophobic caricature in this film, which I will talk about more later. And then the sequel has all of them except for a church. There are no sequences set in a church in The Human Tornado. So it just barely misses a perfect 12 out of 12.
Yeah.
Okay, so you basically have an open invitation to join us every time, but we only seem to be able to get you on when we do Blaxploitation films.
Yeah.
Which is fine. But you suggested Dolomite and The Human Tornado.
Yes, and I did that because the man who is more or less responsible for creating these films is somebody I'm a big fan of. That is, of course, the illustrious Mr. Rudy Ray Moore, who, as we were discussing a little bit before we turned on the microphone, was primarily a stand-up comic. And he became popular in the 70s for what Wikipedia refers to as party records, which were these comedy albums of especially ribald blue material, with a lot of colorful profanity and exaggerated stories of sexual conquest and things of that nature. And it is in these records that Rudy Ray Moore would develop this character that he called Dolomite. And it's a really interesting thing when you look at it through a cultural lens, because the traditional Blaxploitation hero is already a completely exaggerated version of traditional masculinity. They are these hyper-masculine, super tough, macho characters that women find completely sexually irresistible. And they are totally badass and extremely tough and always in service, usually, almost always in service of getting back at the white society that suppresses and holds them back. And what makes the Dolomite persona interesting is that it is itself an exaggeration of this already cartoonish archetypal character. So if John Shaft is the sex machine, to all the chicks, and the private dick who is always there for his fellow brother man, Dolomite is completely cartoonishly virile and superhuman in his ability to defend himself and the people he perceives as important to him from the white homogeny.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's by design or just Rudy Ray Moore's idea of that character.
Right, and that's something that's really interesting, is because according to people who knew Rudy Ray Moore in real life, apparently he was gay, or at least bisexual.
Hmm.
And that makes it tempting to read the Dolomite character as a parody of what black society thought a man had to be here in the funky, groovy 70s. But I don't think these movies have that much irony in them. I think Dolomite is very much a persona Rudy Ray Moore created. If you've seen any of his other films, he basically plays this same character in almost everything he made. Like, Petey Wheatstraw, The Devil's Son-in-Law, is a Dolomite movie in everything but name.
Oh.
Even directed by the guy who did Human Tornado, right?
Right, yeah, yeah. And yeah, that was one of his many collaborators. And I'm sorry if I'm just rambling on and talking over everybody.
No, that's okay.
Excuse me. But, you know, later in his career, in the twilight of his career in the 90s and 2000s, he came off as slightly bitter that he felt he had been written out of the history of black popular culture. And if you listen to what Rudy Ray Moore said in interviews and TV appearances, according to him, he was the most influential stand-up black comic of his time, and he also invented rap music.
Okay.
Well, I can kind of see that.
And while a lot of pop culture historians do acknowledge that the kind of free verse, rhyming, rambling stories he would tell on his records are something of a precursor to rap music as a genre, I think saying he invented it is maybe giving him a little more credit than he deserves.
No.
I don't think you can invent rhyming.
No, I don't either. But nevertheless, he is a fascinating figure, and as we will discuss in more detail in a minute, his films are completely independently made, extremely low budget, and he never let that lack of resources or money, and some would even say the lack of talent, keep him from making what I feel are incredibly entertaining motion pictures.
Yeah, they're definitely entertaining, and I think especially the first one, Dolomite, out of all the blaxploitation films we've discussed so far, is the one that feels most like an actual exploitation film.
Oh yeah, it's grimy.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
Cheap and lots of nudity.
Yeah, there's lots of nudity in the second one too, but anyway. This, you kind of raise an interesting point about like the irony of these films. Like the first film, I wasn't sure like how funny it was supposed to be, because the choreography is obviously like very inept. You know, it's horrible, but is it supposed to be? Is it supposed to be funny? I wasn't really sure because, you know, Rudy Ray Moore, he's a comedian, right? So, like,
right,
if he's making horribly choreographed action scenes, is that something intentional? Is he supposed to be making us laugh with that? Or is that, like, a failed attempt at a badass action scene? I couldn't really tell. Now, the second one, which we'll get into later, yeah, that definitely felt like comedy. But for the first film, Dolomite, I wasn't really sure if I was supposed to be laughing or not.
Well, I'm of the opinion that, you know, obviously these movies are funny very intentionally. There are many things in them that are clearly meant to be comedic. But I think the action scenes, at least in this first one, were very much intended to portray more as like a traditional badass action hero. But unfortunately, his abilities in martial arts make David Carradine look like Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
Well, the end credits does say he got some help from the Chuck Norris, what was it called? The Dojo of Chuck Norris or whatever. So even Chuck Norris couldn't help him. He's just that bad.
Chuck Mandu, I think.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And, you know, it is interesting that even though Moore is not credited with directing either of these movies, they still, everything he was involved in, he still feels like the auteur of most, if not all, of his movies.
Yeah, when this film got done, I was kind of surprised he wasn't the credited director. It's actually, for Dolomite, it's Derville Martin, who has a small role in the film as Willie Green, the bad guy.
Yeah, he's Dolomite's archenemy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, D'Urville Martin was a regular in blaxploitation films in the 70s. I mean, he was in a bunch of films with Fred Williamson, including several of which who have titles that I will not repeat. And
why? No, you got to say them. You have to say them now. No, I'm kidding. Don't say them.
He's also in Rosemary's Baby, so he does, and Who's Coming to Dinner, so he did have some, what I guess you would call above ground, more mainstream roles, but this is mostly the kind of thing he was known for.
Okay. Yeah, the first Dolomite, I think it's a pretty good movie, but it could have used some tightening up, in my opinion. Like, there's like the big rap sequence about the Titanic, where he goes on for like 12 minutes, like talking about like, this is a limerick about the Titanic. Bunch of sons of bitches lost all their riches, and it goes on for like 24 hours, and it kind of hurts the pacing of the film. And there are a few moments like that, like there's like a big dance sequence. It's like a variety show at times. It has this party festival atmosphere, which I don't know, maybe that's reflective of his records that he made. I do not know. I've never listened to any, but I don't know. It could have used some tightening up, but it's still a pretty enjoyable movie in my opinion.
Well, the bit you reference about the Titanic, that is directly from one of his records. And the signifying monkey bit is like, and I think he does that in the second movie. That is probably his most well-known comedy bit, so.
Okay.
It was weird that, though, that scene, I think it takes place in like a parking lot. But you can barely hear what he says because of all the cars coming by.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm completely convinced that all the people that gather in the parking lot to listen to him in that scene were not actors. They were just people they found. Maybe they were friends. Maybe they just grabbed them off the street. But and that's reflective of the extremely low budget, perhaps even non-professional quality of the movie making on display here.
Yeah, it's definitely a low-budget film. As I mentioned, the action scenes, despite some help from the Chuck Norris Dojo, are laughable. There's parts where I couldn't tell, like, who was the bad guy, who was the good guy fighting. It's just ridiculous. There's a scene where he punches a hole through some guy and rips out his intestines, I think, and kills him that way?
Yeah.
I don't yet know. Yeah, it's special effects aren't great, so you can't really tell what the hell is going on.
You mean the main bad guy at the end?
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched this one on YouTube. I assume you did as well.
Yeah.
And the actual ripping out of the guts is not shown there in that version. So it is kind of confusing. Because he puts his hand there and then it cuts to him looking at his bloody hand, basically.
Well, there's a brief shot of the guy on the ground with like a split-second shot of some gore, I guess you could say,
Okay. Considering
the budget.
It felt cut down.
Yeah, it felt cut down, yeah.
I watched the Blu-ray, but as far as I know, that is the same print that's streaming on Tubi and here in the U.S. and probably on YouTube, I would imagine. I always took it that Dolomite rips Willie Green's heart out at the end, but yeah, it is edited extremely awkwardly, and you don't really have a good idea of what just happened. And another example of the ineptness of the action sequences is anytime there's a a gunshot that goes off. The timing between the muzzle flare and the squib going off is never correct.
That is fair to say, yes.
I also noticed that I don't think that any of the singers that we see were told what song they were singing during recording. I don't know if you noticed that their mouths don't match the song.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And as it was mentioned, the a big part of blaxploitation movies in general is music, but especially as the 70s went on, more and more films started to devote screen time to musical numbers, to like bands performing. So it's not an insignificant part of both of these movies.
No. No, in the sequel, it's more Rudy Ray Moore himself that he promotes.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, I mean, this was a film that, you know, Rudy Ray Moore as an actor, when he's doing bits that he has clearly practiced and had a lot of experience doing, you know, he's fine. He's an extremely entertaining screen presence. But anytime the movie asks him to do any rudimentary expositionatory dialogue, his acting, I would call it stiff.
Well, he turns profanity into poetry and poetry into profanity. I mean, this has some of the best swearing I've ever heard in a movie before. I mean, it's fun just listening to him talk.
Oh, and that is what is amazing about these films, is the turns of phrase. You rat soup eaten, born insecure, honky motherfucker.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
A term that I have incorporated into my daily lexicon, of course.
I think you can say motherfucker better than Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh, yeah. That's what I was thinking. It's absurd, like, how good he is at that.
Yeah, and that's, I think, part of what these movies have such a big cult following for, is just his very unique screen presence and ability to deliver these incredibly bizarre and amusing turns of phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good that you call it screen presence, because something that went through my mind watching this one is, like, he doesn't necessarily have charisma, but he does have a sort of childlike enthusiasm that really rubs off on the viewer.
Yeah, I think that describes the entire movie. Like, it doesn't really function in a lot of the ways a traditional film is supposed to function, but everybody is on screen is having so much fun, and that very much rubs off on the audience. Like, you have fun too watching a bunch of these people just goof off and be weird and crazy and funny on camera.
Yeah, that's part of the appeal. You're right. And I do think it goes on a little too long after the big fight scene at the end. There's still like 10 minutes left after that.
Yeah.
We get like a scene in the hospital where the bad guys shoot a hospital bed with like the bed sheet covering the pillows. And it's like, typically in hospitals, when you pull the bed sheets over someone's head, that typically means that they're already dead. So you don't really need to shoot them. Like, that's probably not the right room in that case. But it's a good action scene. Well, I mean, it's a terrible action scene, but I mean, it's amusing in its own way. You know, and like, it almost feels like a slow motion fight in a way when like Rudy Ray Moore comes out and he's like punching people slowly, I might add. And they're kind of tumbling over and like knocking out a window. And then Jerry Jones shows up dual wielding revolvers, for God's sakes. And he just starts shooting people. By that time, I was starting to check out a little bit from the film because it kind of felt like it took place after the climax. But
yeah,
I can kind of forgive it. You know, you can kind of forgive it.
Yeah, and that's, I think, another reflection of the fact that these movies were made by people who were not super well-versed in how films are supposed to be made. So, yeah, the pacing is frequently off, and there are long lulls that are kind of slow. And yeah, I agree. The movie ends and then basically goes on for 10 minutes. And the same thing is even more true about the sequel, which we'll discuss more later. But yeah, so that's just either endings that go on too long or endings that are incredibly abrupt and make no sense are reoccurring in Rudy Ray Moore's movies. Disco Godfather is one that ends extremely abruptly.
Oh, now I want to see it, though. So I like it when a movie knows when to end. Like, marked for death. Well, like, it ends.
You
like,
should see it. You should see Disco Godfather.
Okay. Is it something everybody should see? Well, everybody who likes blaxploitation?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. All of Moore's films are essential viewing if you want to get into this subgenre, I feel.
Okay.
At least all the ones that he starred in. And you know, another thing, another good example of how low budget this film was and how they maybe didn't know what they were doing is the boom mic appears on screen so much that it probably should have a credit.
That is true. Yeah. I could have sworn during the hospital scene at the end, there's like two of them in like one shot at the same time. It seemed like, maybe I'm exaggerating, but that's what it felt like.
You know, it's everywhere, all over this movie. And another, you know, we talk about how Rudy Ray Moore is, you know, has a wonderful screen presence, but is maybe a stiff actor. A lot of the other people in this playing his various girls, or my favorite is a character that's extremely peculiar. He is referred to as both the Creeper and the Hamburger Pimp.
It's Ron McDonald.
He's played by an actor named, or I should say a person named Zanus Rackstraw. This is his only credit. And I believe there is zero chance that that guy was just a, you know, I believe there was zero chance that guy wasn't a real junkie.
Oh, okay. You have to remind me, who was he again?
He's the guy who shows up. I don't even, I think Dolomite's trying to get information on the street. And this is the guy who shows up and he orders a hamburger from a food truck. He introduces himself by saying he's so bad he kicks his own ass twice a day.
Oh, yeah, I remember that now. That was random. I'll just leave it at that. It was kind of a random scene. Yeah, I get where you're coming from with that take. Yeah, it's just...
The whole movie is random.
Yeah, well, that is true. That is indeed true. But that was especially weird. Just, like, this crackhead ordering a hamburger out of nowhere. That kind of threw me for a loop more than the rest of the content in the film. But, yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, and that definitely points towards the throw-it-in attitude of these films. Like, hey, this guy's funny. Let's write a scene around him and we'll find a place for it in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that's the feeling I got, at least the thought I got, is that Chris Rock's performance or character in I'm Gonna Get You Sucker was based off of this one.
That's a possibility, yeah. I mean, if you want to talk about how these movies influenced later films, like the plot of Black Dynamite is very inspired by this one. In fact, this movie... I should say Black Dynamite is basically a combination of this movie and Disco Godfather with a little bit of Three the Hard Way thrown in, but...
Okay. I've seen Black Dynamite. I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Oh, Black Dynamite, I love. That movie's brilliant. Another thing, speaking of the supporting cast in this movie, the evil mayor, who is, of course, a, you know, evil white man who is putting drugs into the black neighborhoods and directly involved with organized crime. That is played by an actor named High Pike, who you might recognize from the movie Hack-O-Lantern, in which he played the gravelly-voiced satanic grandfather.
Another cliche role for him.
Yeah, he was also the cabbie in Blade Runner, is probably what he's actually best known for. But I know him for Hack-O-Lantern.
Okay. Blade Runner, Hack-O-Lantern... Yeah.
Yeah, and looking at his IMDb page, some of his other credits are the first nudie musical, The Erotic Adventures of Don Quixote, and Vamp with Grace Jones and Billy Drago.
He's been everywhere. Yeah. Yes. There's also like a black nationalist preacher in this film, Reverend Gibbs, played by Wes Gale. He was kind of a memorable character, I think. He had... a couple of henchmen who just, like, sit around in coffins all day waiting for bad guys to show up so that they can, like, pretend to be dead and then not dead as they pull out their guns, you know? That's a nice little scene of him, like, stocking up weapons for, like, the race war that's coming. So I thought that was kind of a cool character. And it checks off that mark. Churches and blaxploitation films.
Right, and it's funny, though, because the role of religion is always an interesting part in these kind of movies because they represent kind of the traditional morality that the hero will inevitably have to go against in order to fight the power. But in this movie, the Reverend is full of shit. He's sleeping with women on the side. He's a completely farcical character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stocking up on guns. That's really good. I like that. That's what all reverends should be doing.
I like how he just goes into what you call it. As soon as the white people walk into his church, he goes from having a militant speech to just talking about something every day, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, just talking about
Jesus.
That
was a nice joke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that moment is an example of something in the film that's very obviously intentionally funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's sort of an example of how, like, this movie is clowning on the pillars of the black community, if you will, but also in the service of mocking the white majority.
Yeah. And, well, we forgot to mention Queen Bee, Lady Reed. She's right. The person who breaks Dolomite out of prison at the beginning. Well, doesn't really break him out of prison, but she goes to, like, the warden and says, hey, there's a drug problem in my neighborhood. Can you get Dolomite out of prison to solve it? Because that's the way the prison system works.
Yeah.
And she, it's like, hey, we got a criminal here, but he might help the other criminals. Well, maybe that's the way it works. I don't know. I'm not an expert. I don't have a legal degree or whatever it's called. But
yeah, because...
Yeah, we should probably actually describe the plot of this movie a little bit. It is both very simple and needlessly convoluted, but basically Dolomite is a pimp and a nightclub owner who is released from prison. His rival, Willie Green, has murdered, I believe it's his nephew or his cousin, and taken over his club. And also there's shit with the mafia and the mayor, and none of that's really important. What it is about Dolomite and his kung fu hookers taking back what belongs to him and destroying all who stand in his way. Why Rudy Ray Moore is dressed phenomenally and gets chances to say a lot of really crazy things.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's just, it's the ultimate kung fu pimp film. I mean, it's like, you like pimps, you like kung fu, let's combine them, you got Dolomite. And it works pretty well.
And don't they say, or doesn't the warden say, like, oh yeah, you were put in prison for dealing drugs, but since you were in prison, the problem has only increased, so you're given the chance to solve the problem?
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, that's...
What's that like?
Yeah. That's... Okay, you go first.
I was just going to say, isn't that like that, like, restorative justice? Like, where, like, you don't just throw people in prison, you, like, have them, like, work through their problems together, and, like... Isn't that an example of that, maybe? Like, this hippie New Age stuff?
Well, it doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
And the presence of drugs in these movies is interesting, because a lot of blaxploitation films glorify the drug dealer as, like, this cool dude, but many more of them, including most of Rudy Ray Moore's future films, speaking of Disco Godfather, and that movie is all about getting smack off the street, and Angel Dust. But in this movie, it's like, well, Dolomite is a drug dealer, but he's also, like, against the mafia distributing drugs. Like, the cops plant cocaine on him at one point to try and frame him. So it's very inconsistent over whether or not we're supposed to think the drug problem in the hood is bad or not.
Yeah, pimping is definitely good, though.
It's a moral good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the hookers are happy working for Dolomite.
Yeah. Yes, they all love him. He is a kind man who certainly does not sexually enslave them or get them hooked on drugs to make them more pliable. None of those things. They are willingly his acolytes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really weird that
they're happier with him back than they were when he was locked up.
Yeah, and he teaches them kung fu so they can fight back.
Right.
Yeah. It's like
probably their best customer too.
I'm surprised Chuck Norris helped this film out.
The scene of the girls training in the dojo is features some more hilariously awkward attempts at martial arts.
Yeah, it's just your like stereotypical punch with your left hand, punch with your right hand, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, like then they get into like a little fight where they like stop some guy's gonads back the hell and back, and it's. It's okay. I mean, it's probably not the worst fight scene in the movie.
But, yeah, no, I mean, to me, this is an incredibly entertaining motion picture. And it's steeped in the visual signifiers of blaxploitation. I mean, the whole soundtrack is funk and soul and R&B. Everybody is dressed very colorfully. I mean, obviously, Rudy Ray Moore gets the best outfits, though do not bring him white drawers. He is quite insistent about that. But yeah, I mean, it is one of the definitive blaxploitation films, I think. And the fact that it is a super low budget production that was clearly made totally outside of the Hollywood system and without the support of that infrastructure at all, I think just makes it more charming.
Yeah, I agree with that, definitely.
Charming is a good way of putting it, because, you know, obviously the fight scenes that we went over are terrible, but it's charming because it's funny. It makes you laugh. And how can something make you laugh be bad? Well, how can a movie that makes you laugh not be bad? Okay, that's a better way of putting it, because I can think of some terrible things that make me laugh that I should not like. But just for movies, it makes me laugh, and that's good.
Yeah, and I do want to mention this film also has a magnificent movie poster, which depicts Dolomite holding a very high-tech looking gun that is certainly not in the film, while his kung fu hookers fight a bunch of people in the background. The title is exploding forward towards the viewer. And of course, Rudy Ray Moore has two beautiful women dangling off of his legs. And none of this stuff is very representative of what the film actually looks like in the grand tradition of exploitation cinema.
I was kind of disappointed that the kung fu girls weren't in the movie that much.
Yeah, that's fair to say. They get a kind of a good fight there in the nightclub, and then they're gone. Then the movie drags on for another like 12 minutes doing nothing. But, you know, you're right. It would have been nice to see them kick some more ass. But, oh, and I just noticed this. The cinematography is done by Nicholas Josef von Sternberg. Yeah. So Sternberg does the cinematography for this. I don't know if that's the guy's real name. Josef von Sternberg. Or they just kind of...
Why would you make that name up?
I don't know.
I mean, he had a pretty prolific career, so I guess that was, in fact, his true name. But this was notably his first credit. Oh. And he would go on to work on Petey Wheatstraw, Tourist Trap, Final Justice with Joe Don Baker, No Retreat, No Surrender 2, and a bunch of other shit nobody's seen.
So not quite the original von Sternberg.
No, I don't think so.
Not quite.
But hey, he did No Retreat, No Surrender 2. Classic.
And Slaughterhouse Rock with Tony Basil of Mickey fame. So,
what?
Was a cinematographer on low-budget action and horror films throughout the 70s and 80s, and looks like he primarily did television in the 90s.
Okay.
Oh, it looks like he also did the sequel to The Last Picture Show, Texasville.
Oh.
Is that an action movie, too?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, that definitely is one of his more high-profile products than to go from Dolomite to a Peter Bogdanovich movie is quite a leap.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say about the original Dolomite? Okay.
I was just going to say, are we going to move on to the Human Tornado?
Sounds like we're ready to go on to part two.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Don't rush anybody. But the Human Tornado, this is where things start getting a bit more self-aware about the comedy, I would say. I think after the reception of Dolomite, I think Rudy Ray Moore, he kind of leaned a bit more into like the intentional humor here. Like, there's a lot more overt comedy in this film than like in Dolomite, where a lot of the comedy comes from how horrible it is. That's my take.
I was still wondering, though, how aware he was of it exactly. He's doing a lot of the crazy movements when he does the kung fu.
Yeah.
But then there's also it's sped up and there's slow motion jump that gets shown twice. And was he aware of all of that? Was he...
there is like a rewind section where he like jumps off from a mountain in the raw, and it's like, let's do a rewind of that, and it like shows Johnson again, and it just,
yeah.
I mean, I'm gonna assume that was probably intentionally comedic rather than him showing off his jumbo, but
yeah.
I mean,
yeah, you do see a lot of him in this movie. Yes.
This is just practically soft core right here. This is just like half the movie is people naked.
Yeah.
I hope nobody looked into my window when I was watching this.
I mean, this is definitely a more intentionally comedic production. It is, I would say, a somewhat more professional production. I would think the first movie came out, was successful, so they probably had a little bit more money and resources for the sequel. And I actually love this movie. it would seem to me that most people prefer the original. I actually think the Human Tornado, or as Rudy Ray Moore pronounces it in the theme song, which he sings, the Human Tornado. I actually love this movie. I think this film is a pure, unadulterate peek into Rudy Ray Moore's subconscious, and I very much enjoy spending time in his weird, weird brain.
I prefer it too. Yeah.
Oh, man. This one was a little too loose for me. I love the ideas. I know it's the one where he says, "Bitch, are you for real?" Then, like, shoot somebody. I mean, that's good stuff. I like the ideas here. I like the plot, but it's just so fast and loose with the pacing. It feels like a variety show. Like, the basic plot of him being pursued by a racist hick sheriff is great. I love that. He's having an affair with the hick sheriff's wife. That's a great story. But, it just goes off. We had, like, a subplot about, like, the nightclub back in Los Angeles being taken over. And then there's a subplot about two of the girl hooker kung fu ladies being kidnapped. And it's just so loose and so not focused that by the end I was kind of like, Rudy Ray, no more. Rudy Ray, no more. I can't take any more of this. But, I mean,
I think asking for a straight A to B plot structure or coherent narrative in a Rudy Ray Moore movie is asking for too much, man.
Okay, fair enough. Well, Dolomite kept it together fairly well, I guess you could say. But this one just opens with like a 24-minute like stand-up comedy special that's, I mean, it's kind of funny at times, but it has nothing to do with the rest of the film. It could have been cut out completely to cut down the film by like 25%. And then, like, there's also the issue of it, like, going on, like, for, like, another, like, 12 minutes after the climax is over. And it ends on the most random note of all.
Yes, I agree with you. This movie goes on too long. I always forget that there's 20 minutes left after he rescues his two girls from the Aurora Monster Model Kit torture dungeon that the bad guys have in their mansion.
Yeah.
The film peaks there, and then there's 20 more minutes of movie left, and at that point it's I always check out too, to the point that I always feel like this is a 70 minute movie with a excessive 20 minute epilogue.
That is true, but although the epilogue does have a scene where he makes rats nibble off a guy's Johnson, so that's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
but other than that, it ends on the note where, like, he doesn't even kill the sheriff at the end. He just gets shot several times and survives because he has a bulletproof vest. And is that the ending you want in a Dolomite sequel? Like, the hero getting shot several times and just kind of letting the bad guy go? I don't know. I'm not sure that's what I really wanted to see at the very end, right before credits roll.
Yeah, it's a very weird ending.
Yeah.
Was that supposed to be a bulletproof vest? Because he says something like, "I am immortal." That's not what he says, but that's the meaning of what he says, right?
Oh, well, maybe he's immortal because he has a bulletproof vest on? I don't know. I thought it was a vest because there's no blood on the squibs when he gets shot. So, like, maybe the bullets are hitting the aluminum foil that he's wearing or something like that. Yeah, I don't know.
He does show a vest under his clothes, like as if it's supposed to be body armor, but it does not look like...
Oh, it does not. It does not. It's got to be like aluminum foil that he's wearing right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think logically we are to presume that he has a bulletproof vest on, but to me, the intended message to the audience definitely reads as Rudy Ray Moore can never die.
Yeah, it's a good message.
But I agree with you. And then, you know, the final shot of the movie is his face laughing in victorious triumph. But I agree with you. We absolutely should have seen Dolomite kill the bad guy. I have no idea why the movie does it in that way.
Yeah. But other than that, I also didn't like that there's a little less action, physical killing action. I mean, there's a lot of bedroom action, but there's not as much fighting action as much as there is in the first film. It feels like the middle act is also entirely devoid of action, with the exception of that one guy getting shot in the back a few times with some squibs. But other than that, there's some good action at the beginning, some good action in the third act, but the middle act is just nudity for like 20 minutes. And I don't want to sound like a prude, but I would have preferred more killing.
Very spoken like a true American.
Yes,
like, fucking is bad, killing is good.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, and that is actually the middle of the movie has one of my favorite scenes, maybe my favorite scene in the entire Rudy Ray Moore oeuvre, and that is where he goes to the wife of the mob boss, and he dresses up as a professional artist, putting on a costume and a funny voice. It's total Bugs Bunny shit. And then he, you know, Dolomite's sexual virility is such that he seems to literally hypnotize this woman into being ravaged by him, and it results in this surreal dream sequence in which she is laying on giant children's blocks and three naked black bodybuilders emerge from a toy box and proceed to have sex with her on a slide. And then the scene ends with Dolomite making love to her, let's use that word, with such ferocity that the house actually collapses around them.
Yeah, we should, it's very subtle. It's also funny that the child blocks spell out bed.
B-E-N-D. Right. Just so you get the message.
Very subtle.
Yeah. It's also kind of funny because you can read this as, oh, like, she needs to fantasize about other men when she fucks Rudy Ray Moore.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I mean, I think the intended message is probably like, you know, the power of the black male sexuality is so overwhelming to the white woman because the white male sexuality is completely inadequate in comparison. But yeah, that is an interesting way to read it, that she has to fantasize about other guys.
And they do mention before he goes there that she is a total nympho. Mm-hmm. So he shows her a painting of two naked people hugging, and then that's enough. That gets her going.
She loses her mind over it.
And and it's a completely it feels to me like something out of a Herschel Gordon Lewis movie, or like one of these really weird indie, no talent, outsider art sort of filmmakers. And I think you could probably compare it to like some of the artsier porno movies that were coming out in the 70s. It's just a very strange, weird sequence, and I love it because it is so inexplicable. Because the rest of the movie isn't like that.
Well, you're right, but it's still pretty weird.
My favorite scene by far, though, is the scene where he just walking on the sidewalk, picks up an apple, takes a bite, and it says, I hope the women in California are as good as this apple. End scene.
In voiceover, yeah.
Yeah.
The whole thing has a fever dream quality to it.
Very much. And I'm just looking at the credits for this movie. This is amusing to me. A man named Howard Jackson is in the film. And even though, and that is, in fact, a martial artist of some renown and a stuntman who worked on some of the later Bloodfist movies and a bunch of movies with Chuck Norris. But in this, he is in fact credited as world karate champion Howard Jackson.
Well, it's like a variety show. It's like, here's the guy who knows nunchucks. Here's Howard Jackson. Here's the stand-up comedy set. Here's the nudity. Here's the action scene. It's just, it's a carnival.
Here's a 5-minute sequence of a woman doing a gyrating, I think it is supposed to be some sort of Afrocentric dance, but it amounts to her having her ass in the camera for a good while.
Yes.
Which is fair enough. Up to this point, we've only seen boobs.
Get the variety.
Yeah.
We need somebody for the ass men.
Yeah, somebody for the ass men in the audience.
Yeah, not just Rudy Ray Moore's ass, but somebody else's, please. Yeah.
There's a lot of sex and nudity in this movie, and another inexplicable moment is when Dolomite goes to see one of his girlfriends, and of course, you know, he is completely overwhelming in bed, and she, you know, says that nobody can make love to her like he can, but before they do it, they're doing some sort of calisthenic jazzercise on the bed with jump rope. It's like, what the fuck is happening?
Yes! That threw me for a loop. I wasn't sure what they were going for.
And
there.
The whole movie is kind of like that. Much of the film has the ability to throw the viewer for a loop.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk about the cliches of the blaxploitation genre, I think this one leans even more than the first one did into the racist white man because the redneck sheriff and his posse that are chasing Dolomite throughout the film and are ostensibly the main villains of the movie, except for when the plot forgets about them and focuses on something else. I think every other word that comes out of their mouth is a racial slur.
Yes, it's kind of disturbing how much they relish saying having their being in their role that they have. They you can tell these guys are hamming it up and enjoying themselves, maybe a little too much, but maybe it's part of the fun of the movie. I don't know.
Yeah, well, anytime you have a white actor in a film where they get to use a lot of words like that, there's always this kind of there's always this unsettling undercurrent of, like, is this okay? Like, are you enjoying pretending to be racist?
It's the 70s, man.
Different time. We're all on drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. In fact, like, I think, like, this opening scenes of, like, the hick sheriff and his posse, those were some of the best scenes for me. You know, like, Dolomite making his great escape by jumping off the cliff and, like, the poor sheriff's wife getting shotgunned to death. It's wild, and that's probably the highlight. Well, they shotgun the guy's car and it explodes. And I wasn't sure, like, are they dead now? Are they dead? Is that the end of that subplot? Or is this, like, going to continue? I don't know. But it keeps on going, fortunately, so we have maybe some plot thread overarching the whole film. But that was probably the highlight for me, some of the opening scenes. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And it sort of implies that this movie is going to be like, oh, Soul Brother in the South fighting, you know, these redneck sheriffs, which was also, you know, a frequent plot in blaxploitation movies. The Jim Brown movie Slaughter is basically that. But no, that's not what the movie's about at all. Instead, they go to L.A. They encounter a caricature of a gay man in a car that, of course, immediately wants to have sex with Dolomite, who is aghast as a shining, overwhelming symbol of male, straight, heterosexual power. He has no interest in that. Which, again, knowing that Rudy Ray Moore was gay in real life makes that scene very interesting to interpret.
I was surprised by how not homophobic the characters were, though.
Oh, yeah. 'Cause they're like,
oh, this guy's gay. We don't want to have sex with you, but fine.
Yeah. You're right. I was expecting an F slur there for a while. I really was. I mean,
yeah.
But they didn't. So kudos to them, I guess, for not doing that.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any version of this movie that you would call progressive exactly. Though. I mean, you know, in the proud tradition of exploitation films in general, but blaxploitation movies especially did not treat women great. I mean, usually they were eye candy or objects if they weren't raped and killed, so...
Yeah. And there's two names we haven't mentioned yet, two kind of big names, though I think they're both credited under different names than what they're known as. The first one being Ernie Hudson, obviously. A very bald, young...
Playing Bo.
Ernie Hudson, playing Bo, yes. When we first see him, it's sort of like a wide shot, and I was like, oh shit, is this like an early uncredited role for Ernie Hudson? But no, his role is kind of big, actually.
Yeah, he's credited as Lewis Hudson, and he is almost unrecognizable. Like, if I didn't know it was Ernie Hudson, I'm not sure I would pick up on that. He looks, with the bald head and looking so much younger than we're used to seeing him in Ghostbusters and 100 other things, it's unexpected.
Pleasant surprise, though.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the other big name? Because I don't know who the other one you're talking about is.
Well, there's two credited cinematographers, a guy named Bob Wilson and a guy named Gene Condy. And Gene Condy is actually Dean Cundey.
Oh, Dean Cundey. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
I didn't know this watching the movie, no.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
The legend.
Oh, that's crazy.
The cinematographer of Halloween, The Thing, Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park, yeah.
The Parent Trap.
I mean, he was Steven Spielberg's go-to cinematographer for years, and John Carpenter, and is still working to this day. I had no idea he worked on this, and it wasn't even his first movie. It was like his 10th credit. He had done... I'm really curious to how he got involved in this, because I can't imagine they had a lot of money. I mean, he wasn't, like, a big name yet, but he was established. Like, he had worked on The Witch Who Came in from the Sea at this point, and a couple other low-budget horror and blaxploitation movies. But yeah, obviously after Halloween, he would go on to do do many, many well-known notable films. And DC Cab.
And DC Cab, yeah.
Well, there's two cinematographers credited. Maybe he just walked off when he realized they couldn't pay him. I don't know.
That seems completely probable.
But it's also funny because 2 weeks ago we talked about how both Black Belt Jones, Black Samurai, and one other movie were all edited by Michael Kahn, Steven Spielberg's regular editor. Mm-hmm. And now Dean Kunde shows up. It's like, holy shit. Steven Spielberg just watched a lot of black exploitation movies and went like, I want that guy, I want that guy, that guy.
Now I just want to see Rudy Ray Moore stars Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
That would have been a very different movie. And notably, the other credited DP on this, Bob Wilson, has two other credits.
Oh,
okay, well.
Right, yeah, he worked on what, a movie called Street Girls that looks like a softcore porno, though was apparently written by Barry Levinson? Like, that Barry Levinson? Okay.
Oh, shit.
All right. Fucking weird. Well, you know, so many, talking about Spielberg, I mean, he didn't, but, he plucked Joe Dante out of, the Roger Corman New World Pictures kind of world. So there is sort of a weird path from 70s exploitation cinema to, a lot of big movies and big names that would arise later in the 80s and 90s. So it's not unheard of, but surprising to see that Dean Kunde worked on The Human Tornado.
Yeah.
But I love this movie. I'm not going to tell you that it's a good film. I'm not going to tell you that it's a coherent movie, because it absolutely is not. But I find it to be pure entertainment. Rudy Ray Moore was, for whatever flaws he had, a complete original. And I think this movie is very much a peek into his weird, weird brain and is a pure representation and distillation of everything he was about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I probably appreciate it more than I like it, because I like the ideas. I mean, it's funny at times, very funny, but as a coherent film, it's not coherent. Drags on for a bit too long in parts. You know, the ending, as we kind of mentioned, the epilogue goes on forever and ever and ever. There's the prologue, which is the stand-up comedian set, which goes on forever. But the ideas are solid.
Would you rather have him perform his comedy in a parking lot where you can barely understand him?
No, I think the Human Tornado probably did the comedy set a bit more understandable than the human than Dolomites. Yes, that is better than the Titanic scene. Yes, that is true. Yeah. There's some good jokes in the stand-up comedian scene.
Yeah, that's a good example of how they definitely had a little bit more money, not a lot, but a little bit more money on this one than they did on the previous film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it gets a bit more self-aware, so they kind of know, oh, the guy running around naked is now a joke now. So that's so it's in some regards, it kind of improves over the original, but I prefer Dolomite overall because it feels a bit more like a film, maybe, as opposed to the Human Tornado, which feels like a variety show almost at times, which I'm sure it has its appeal. Some people are going to love that, and that's okay. I mean, that's fine. But I don't know. I would prefer something a bit more tight.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's totally a fair criticism. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I preferred Human Tornado because of the bizarre scenes, the apple eating scene, and the lovemaking scene, and the fantasy scene, and all his fucking gesturing when he's doing the kung fu.
Oh, my God.
His
yeah,
head wobbling.
The sped up,
so funny.
I guess they sped up the kung fu to make it look a little less stiff and awkward than it was in the last one, but it doesn't really make it look any better.
No. It looks like a Benny Hill skit.
I didn't think about that, but that is true.
Yeah, and we did not mention, we talked a little bit about the two girls that are in this torture chamber that the movie cuts to whenever it needs a little bit more sleaze. And there's also this stereotypical Halloween witch there. It's another example of how weird and all over the place this movie is.
She kind of reminded me of the witch in Robin Hood's Men in Tights.
I see it.
Yeah. And there's the bad guy who's guarding the two girls, and he looks like he has his beard painted on.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yes. Oh, my God.
What a weird choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the one who sticks the hand grenade through her, in between her knees.
Yes. And the scene where Dolomite rescues her, he's just looking so awkward because she says something like, "Be careful, there's a grenade between my legs." And you're watching and you're going, "One liner, Dolomite, come on. this is your shot." Kicked a grenade or something, but he just really awkwardly sets her free, and then they jump away from the grenade. Like, ah, come on.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, like I said, they just, you know, they probably didn't have the money to shoot the scene a second time.
I was a little disappointed he didn't shove, like, every crack the bad guy's neck, didn't throw him on top of the lady who was laying underneath the knife trap, and then the knife trap would fall down on top of him. Then he would be like a human shield for the lady. I don't know. Maybe the budget didn't allow for it, but I would have preferred to see that.
I mean, that would have made sense for a movie where they didn't make the story up as they went along.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah, I prefer the human tornado, but I do feel like Dolomite, it just feels like a more influential, important movie in the history of blaxploitation. So I maybe would recommend that one more than I would The Human Tornado. But if you like it, hey, check out the sequel.
Yeah, I think that's fair. This is, this Dolomite is, as was said, I guess more of a real movie. And this one is more of like a pure Rudy Ray Moore vehicle. But if you like his screen presence and his bizarre sense of humor and the weird shit he does, then yeah, absolutely. Check it out. And then also check out P.D. Wheatstraw and Disco Godfather, because those two are also insane and excellent.
Coming next year, Rudy Ray even more.
I'm up for it. I'm absolutely down for that. And then I can introduce you guys to the joys and pleasures of putting your weight on it, which is a reoccurring line in Disco Godfather.
Okay.
Oh. I think that's what Rudy Ray Moore does to some of the girls in this movie.
And I mentioned how the first film's poster was not really representative of the actual product. This one's poster features, and I should say the main one sheet, features a giant Rudy Ray Moore emerging from a tornado. I think the implication seems to be that he is swinging his fist so hard that it is generating this tornado. And the force of this meteorological phenomenon he's created is bending buildings into tossing cars up in the air and throwing multiple people all around. And needless to say, nothing like that occurs in this motion picture.
No. They didn't have the budget. But, oh, man.
But it is a glorious piece of art. I would love to have both of these one sheets on my wall with the many other... I say that, but I have about 50 one sheets and tubes and no place to put those up. So I don't know what I would do with more.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. The Human Tornado. I appreciate it, but it's flabbier than Dolomite's Ding-a-ling. So
yeah.
I would appreciate it, maybe some editing at some places. But I mean, I appreciate what they're going for, but I'm not sure they pulled it off, in my opinion, but hey.
Though I'm looking, you got me curious. I looked up the editor on this movie, Hugo Grimaldi, who also worked on the English cut of the second Godzilla movie. And people who know their Godzilla history know that that film was greatly re-edited into a completely different movie called Gigantus the Fire Monster over here. So that is the level of talent and professionalism we were dealing with in the editing department.
Okay, we got the Godzilla editor.
All right, is there anything else we want to talk about? The theme song for this movie is great. Like I said, he rhymes tornado with later.
Well, it's probably not the worst rhyme I've ever heard in my life. I mean, I live in the United States, so I've heard country music before.
You know, I'm tempted to refer to the way Rudy Ray Moore talks as a version of African American English vernacular, but nobody else talks like that, so I think that's just his unique way of speaking.
Yeah.
Yes.
Rudy Ray Moore-ish.
All right, well, I had a great time talking about these movies with you guys, and
yeah, me too. Thank you again for joining.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll see you next year, but maybe before then even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I definitely need to get back on the show more often. I'm sure we will have some weird topic coming down the drain that I can speak on with authority. I do apologize if I just talked
that's fine.
Too much. I've got a lot to say about this shit.
It was very informative. I mean, I learned a lot of things about this guy, yeah.
I strive to be educational in all ways.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, thank you for joining. To our listeners, thank you for listening. Go visit the website, alloutofbubblegum.com. Join the Discord. Check out the Patreon. And we'll see you next week.
Yeah, and don't be a rat soup eating, born insecure, honky motherfucker.
That too. Yeah. All right. Bye-bye.
Right, bye. Elephants and lobsters are off their knees. I don't want no dilapidated C-sapping pigeon, throw the cross-eyed, bow-legged son of a god's a messing with me. I've been known to